Imagine looking down at your hand right now and realizing the diamond has just it's fallen out of your wedding ring.
Oh man, that immediate hot flash of panic.
Right. The way your stomach completely drops. But now imagine you realize it's missing while you're standing in this like pitch black, windowless room with a dirt floor.
Oh, that's a nightmare.
And it's covered in decades of dust and debris. You don't have a smartphone flashlight. You don't have, smooth tile to scan.
Yeah, you just hit the dark.
Just the dark, the dirt, and this terrifying realization that a foundational piece of your life is just gone.
And that kind of visceral chest-tightening panic, that's something most of us can instantly relate to, right?
Totally.
But the wild thing is, when we encounter that exact same scenario written down in a 2,000-year-old text, we tend to completely miss those
I
states.
really
We
do.
read it like a mild inconvenience, rather than a devastating crisis.
Which brings us to the mission for today's deep dive. Welcome in, by the way. We have this fascinating document in front of us, simply titled The Lost Coin.
It's a great piece.
It really is. And we're going to use it to tackle this major problem we all face when we encounter foundational ancient texts like, especially the Bible.
Oh, for sure. We have this terrible habit of just skimming.
Yes, we do this like surface reading, right? We grab the most obvious bumper sticker moral of the story and we just move on.
Yeah, we check the box and keep walking.
Exactly. So our goal today for you listening right now is to prove that deep research into historical context is honestly the only way to get the actual payload out of these texts.
Because if you just skim the surface, you're literally being robbed of the actual experience.
Right. It's like looking at a topographical map of Mount Everest and thinking, you know what it feels like to freeze in the death zone.
That's a perfect analogy. I mean, the map is technically accurate, sure, but it conveys absolutely zero of the reality.
None of it.
And this short story we're exploring today is just a perfect case study for this, because without the historical reality of the first century Middle East, this story it falls entirely flat for a modern reader.
So, okay, let's unpack this. We are looking at a story known as the Parable of the Lost Coin.
Right.
It's found in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 15, verses 8 through 10. And our source material actually points out that it sits directly in the middle of a literary triptych.
A story in three parts.
Right. Told by Jesus.
And the setting here is it's critical to everything that follows. I mean, Jesus isn't just giving a random TED talk about misplaced
Right.
objects.
He's not just like, hey, don't lose your keys.
Exactly. He is in the middle of a very tense standoff.
Yeah.
The religious elite of the day are actively grumbling, like publicly complaining, because Jesus is out there eating with tax collectors and outcasts.
People, the establishment considered, morally dirty.
Completely socially untouchable.
He's hanging out with the wrong crowd, and the authorities are demanding to know why.
Yeah.
So he answers them with three stories.
Right.
The first one is like this massive global cultural touchstone, right? The parable of the lost sheep. A shepherd leaves the 99 sheep to find the one that wandered off. And the third story is arguably the most famous piece of short fiction in human history, the parable of the prodigal son.
Which everyone knows.
Everyone knows it. But sandwiched right there in the middle, easily skipped, is this tiny story about a woman who loses a single coin. It's literally three verses long.
Yeah. And because of its length, it suffers from severe middle child
It
syndrome.
really does.
I mean, people read the epic stakes of the lost sheep. They read this intense family drama of the prodigal son, and in between, they just gloss over a woman misplacing some pocket change.
I'll admit, when I first read those three verses, my modern brain just immediately judged her reaction.
Oh, how so?
Well, she loses a coin, right?
Yeah.
And she proceeds to light a lamp, sweep her entire house, and then throw a massive party for her neighbors when she finds it.
Right.
If I drop a quarter in my kitchen, I do not tear the house apart.
No, of course not.
If it rolls under the refrigerator, it belongs to the refrigerator now.
It's the fridge's quarter now.
Exactly. So why on earth is this woman throwing a neighborhood block party over a coin?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the original Greek text doesn't just say she lost, quote unquote, money.
Okay.
It specifies exactly what she dropped. It was a Greek silver drachma.
The drachma.
Yeah. And in the economy of first century Palestine, a drachma was roughly equivalent to a Roman denarius.
Okay, so I see those words in the text, but honestly, they mean absolutely nothing to my modern wallet.
Fair
Are
enough.
we talking about like dropping a $5 bill or losing a $1,000 check?
So a denarius was the standard wage for one full day of grueling physical labor.
A whole day's wage.
A whole day's wage.
But even then, you know, I try to math that onto my life. If I lose a day's pay, I'm incredibly angry. I'm stressed. But I'm probably not turning my house upside down in the middle of the night and waking up the neighbors.
And that's where we have to strip away our modern financial safety nets. We have to look at the agrarian peasant economy of the Roman Empire.
Right. It's a totally different world.
Completely different. This woman's family wasn't building a 401k. They weren't, you know, putting a little away in a high yield savings account each month.
Right.
They were living on the bleeding edge of subsistence.
Like true poverty.
Exactly. For a peasant household in this era, a day's wage wasn't disposable income. It was literally the money required to buy the grain to survive tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
So a bad harvest, an unexpected tax from Rome, or in this case, a lost coin, that meant the very real possibility of starvation.
So losing a drachma isn't dropping a quarter. It's someone today living paycheck to paycheck, dropping a massive chunk of their weekly pay in cash on the street.
Yes.
And just watching the wind blow it away. I mean, that is an existential threat to her family's survival.
It is a severe blow. But historical scholars argue that the stakes were actually much higher than just the daily grocery budget.
Wait, really? Higher than starving?
Yeah, because the parable specifically notes that she had 10 coins and lost one.
Right. I remember that detail.
And based on Middle Eastern cultural practices of the time, the consensus is that these 10 coins represented the woman's dowry, which was known as a simedi.
A simedi. Our source mentions this was often worn as jewelry, right?
Yes, exactly. A woman's dowry was frequently fashioned into a headdress. The silver coins would actually be pierced, strung together, and worn prominently across the forehead or woven into the hair.
So everyone could see it.
Highly visible. And in a patriarchal society where a woman had very few legal rights to property, this headdress was her ultimate insurance policy.
Right, because she didn't own the land.
Right. If her husband died or, you know, abruptly divorced her, that string of coins was literally the only wealth she could legally claim as strictly her own.
Oh, wow. That completely changes the psychological weight of the story.
Doesn't it?
This wasn't just the rent money sitting in a jar on the kitchen table. This was her personal safety net. And more than that, it was a highly visible public symbol of her marriage covenant.
Exactly. It signaled her status as a married woman of worth.
Which brings me back to the wedding ring analogy we started with. If you look down and the diamond is gone,
yeah,
you aren't just calculating the market value of the carbon stone, right?
No, you're panicking about what it means.
You are devastated by the emotional and symbolic loss. So losing a coin from her simedi meant her bridal headdress was suddenly incomplete.
Yes.
It was this visible, shameful gap that just broadcasted carelessness.
So the loss of identity, the loss of social status, and the terrifying compromise of her only financial safety net, all of that hits her at exactly the same time.
Just a tidal wave of panic.
Yeah. When you understand the cultural reality of the simedi, her frantic, desperate reaction suddenly seems completely justified.
I completely get why she is panicked now.
Yeah.
The stakes are massive.
Very massive.
But I'm still hung up on the mechanics of how she searches.
Okay. Yeah.
Because the text says she lights a lamp and sweeps the house.
Mm.
If she realizes the coin is missing, why not just wait for the sun to come up the next morning and find the silver when you can actually see what you're doing?
Well, you're projecting modern architecture onto a first century peasant village.
Am I?
Yeah, she couldn't just open the curtains because she almost certainly didn't have windows.
Wait, no windows at all?
Very rarely. I mean, a typical peasant home in first century Palestine was a small, single-room structure made of rough fieldstone or mud brick.
Okay.
The primary design goal of these houses was to keep the intense Middle Eastern heat out during the day and then retain warmth at night.
Right. Insulation.
Exactly. Mm. Windows compromised that thermal mass.
Right.
If a house had any openings at all, they were usually just tiny, narrow slits right near the roof line.
Just to let the air out.
Strictly to let cooking smoke escape, not to let sunlight in.
Okay, so if you step inside one of these houses and shut the heavy wooden door behind you, even at high noon with the sun blazing outside,
you are standing in near total darkness. You are plunged into the dark, which means waiting for morning wouldn't help her at all. The house would be just as dark at 9 a.m. as it was at midnight.
That perfectly explains lighting the lamp.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the floor. Because again, my modern brain imagines sweeping a nice, smooth, hardwood floor, or maybe a stone tile, where a dropped coin would just bounce and settle right in plain sight.
And nothing could be further from the truth. The floor of a peasant home was usually just packed earth.
Just dirt.
Just dirt. In some regions, they might use rough basalt cobblestones, but there was no mortar holding them perfectly flush. It was an incredibly uneven surface.
I can only imagine.
And over the years, that floor would become covered in a thick, permanent layer of dust, dried mud tracked in from the fields, and dried reeds that they often scattered on the floor for insulation.
See, I want you, the listener, to really visualize this environment.
Yeah, picture it.
Think about dropping a small, heavy silver disc into that setting. It falls into pitch darkness. It hits packed dirt or uneven rocks.
It doesn't bounce cleanly.
No. It instantly wedges itself deep into a crack between two cobblestones.
Or worse.
Right, or worse, it just sinks straight down and is immediately buried in a thick, powdery layer of accumulated dirt.
And that brings us to the sweeping, because the Greek word used here for sweeping implies a really forceful, deliberate action.
Okay.
We shouldn't picture someone casually tidying up their kitchen with a modern Swiffer, you know?
She is going to war with this dirt floor.
She has to. She lights a small clay oil lamp. And we have to remember, this isn't a high-powered LED beam.
Right, no mag light here.
It's a tiny vessel of olive oil with a floating flax wick. It gives off a very faint, flickering, smoky glow.
Barely enough light to read by, let alone search by.
Exactly.
So she gets down in the dirt with this tiny flickering flame. And she starts sweeping. What is she actually sweeping with?
Likely just a bundle of dried twigs bound together.
That sounds incredibly inefficient for finding a small coin.
Oh, it was a grueling physical ordeal. She is aggressively scratching at the packed earth and stone, and by doing this, she is instantly kicking up a massive, choking cloud of dust into this unventilated, windowless room.
Oh, man.
She is coughing, she is sweating, her eyes are stinging from the dust and the smoke of the oil lamp.
She is essentially digging blindly.
She is straining her ears, just hoping against hope to hear the tiny, distinctive clink of silver striking a stone over the loud, scratching noise of her twig broom.
Wow.
Or she is praying that as she churns up all this dirt, the flickering, weak light of her lamp will catch just one microscopic glimmer of silver reflecting through the dust cloud.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me.
Yeah.
Because the visceral, deeply uncomfortable physical reality of this search, it completely rewrites the so what of the story.
Absolutely.
Because if we just do the surface reading, it's just, she lost a coin, she looked for it, she found it.
A nice little anecdote.
Right, it's a nice little anecdote. But knowing she is clawing through decades of dirt in a pitch black suffocating room to recover her marriage dowry, how does that change the actual theological payload Jesus was trying to deliver to those grumbling religious leaders?
Well, this raises an important question about the nature of being lost, because if you look at the progression Jesus builds across all three parables in Luke 15, he is illustrating the different ways humanity becomes alienated or lost.
Well, let's track that progression. So parable number one is the sheep.
Right.
How does the sheep get lost? It wanders off out of sheer foolishness. It gets distracted by a patch of grass. It puts its head down, and suddenly it's miles from the flock.
Just wandering.
It didn't mean to get lost. It was just naive.
And then look at parable number three, the prodigal son. He doesn't wander off by accident. He is lost through intentional brazen rebellion.
Right. He actively leaves.
He demands his inheritance early, packs his bags, and deliberately walks away from his father's house.
Okay. So we have foolishness and we have deliberate rebellion. But hold on. Look at the middle child. Look at the coin.
Yeah.
The sheep wanders. The son runs away. But the coin didn't do anything. It's an inanimate object.
It did absolutely nothing. It has no will of its own.
It can't repent of its actions like a son. It can't even bleat for help like a panicked sheep.
It doesn't even possess the awareness to know that it is lost.
Wow.
It is entirely 100% passive. It is just lying there, completely buried in the dark, smothered by the dirt of the floor. It cannot contribute to its own rescue in any way whatsoever.
The seeker has to do all the work.
Yes. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is one of the most profound metaphors for grace in the entire ancient world. Jesus is trying to explain the nature of divine love to a group of religious elites who literally believed that God only loved those who kept themselves clean and earned their way into his favor.
Right. They thought you had to clean yourself up before God would even look at you.
But the parable argues the exact opposite. The coin is found purely because of the immense, relentless, exhausting effort of the seeker.
The woman.
The woman lights the lamp. The woman tears up the dirt floor. the woman inhales the dust until she finds what belongs to her.
That's incredibly powerful.
It is a picture of the divine pursuing people even when they are completely incapable of finding their own way back. Even when they are totally covered in the dirt of the world, offering nothing, unable to even call out for help.
Right.
The grace is completely unearned and uninitiated by the one who is lost.
That completely flips the script on the religious establishment of the time.
Entirely.
But our source material highlights another detail that I think adds a whole new dimension to this. Early church theologians, specifically figures like Augustine and Gregory the Great, they looked at the same historical context and noticed a second, equally powerful layer of metaphor built into this story.
Yes, and this ties directly back to the specific type of currency we talked about earlier, the drachma.
Right. Augustine zeroes in on the fact that a drachma wasn't just a lump of precious metal. It was a minted coin that bore the stamped image of a king or ruler.
And this is a crucial theological detail for ancient audiences. A coin's entire value in the Roman Empire was guaranteed by the image of the emperor stamped onto it.
Right.
If you trace biblical theology all the way back to the very first chapter of Genesis, humanity is uniquely described as being created in the image of God.
The Imago Dei.
Exactly. The Latin theological term is the Imago Dei.
The image of the king is permanently stamped onto the person.
So when you synthesize that concept with the mechanics of the parable, something really beautiful emerges.
Yeah.
You have this silver coin stamped with the image of the ruler. It falls into the dark. It gets wedged in the rocks. It is completely buried in centuries of accumulated dust, mud, and grime.
But the dirt doesn't change the chemical composition of the silver.
And the mud does not erase the stamped image. Just as a silver coin retains its absolute intrinsic worth and the king's image, even when it is hopelessly lost and buried in a dirt floor, a human being retains their divine image and their intrinsic value, even when they are utterly lost in the darkness of the world.
The value is completely independent of the dirt.
Exactly.
Think about the setting again.
Yeah.
The religious leaders were looking at the tax collectors, the sex workers, the outcasts, and all they could see was the dirt.
That's all they saw.
They were actively complaining that Jesus was dirtying himself by associating with them.
They viewed those people as worthless because of the grime on the surface. But Jesus tells a story about a woman who knows exactly how valuable that silver is.
Because it's hers.
She knows the image of the king is under there, and she doesn't care how much dirt she has to sweep through, how much dust she has to inhale, or how undignified she looks getting down on her hands and knees in the dark to get it back.
Because the image is still there, and the value hasn't changed.
Right.
So what does this all mean? Let me get back to you, listening to this deep dive right now. We started this journey with three short, easily skippable sentences about a woman looking for misplaced cash.
Yeah.
If you just do a surface reading of the text, if you refuse to dig into the history, you might walk away thinking the moral of the story is, like, be careful with your finances. Or maybe God is like a lady looking for a dropped quarter.
Which is just a wildly insufficient, tragic underreading of the text. It misses the heartbeat of the narrative entirely.
It really does. But by crossing the bridge into ancient history, by taking the time to truly understand the razor's edge of peasant economics, the massive emotional weight of a dowry headdress, and the suffocating physical reality of searching a dirt floor inside a windowless stone house.
It changes everything.
This seemingly simple, easily ignored tale radically transforms. It stops being a quaint anecdote and becomes this breathtaking high-stakes metaphor about grace, about relentless, exhausting pursuit, and about the indestructible intrinsic value of a human life.
And this is exactly why we cannot settle for surface-level readings of ancient texts today.
No, we really can't.
Whether it's a parable in the Bible, a philosophy text from Greece, or a historical document from Rome. Without the historical context, we are literally reading in the dark.
Yeah.
We're just wandering around a windowless room, making assumptions. But when we do the research, when we understand the context, we light the lamp, and suddenly the text comes alive in ways we never expected.
You have to feel the dirt to understand the story. The context unlocks the empathy, and the empathy unlocks the actual meaning.
Beautifully said.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today, something to take with you as you log off and go about your week.
Okay.
If a single ancient silver coin holds its intrinsic value in its royal image, even when it is completely buried in the thick, suffocating dust of a windowless dirt floor, what unrecognized dirt in our own modern lives or in our own political and social biases might be obscuring the intrinsic value of the people we walk past every single day? And maybe the hearty question is, When we see someone covered in that dirt, how hard are we actually willing to sweep the house to uncover their value?